Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. Let's get right into it. Last week saw a heated exchange in the Oval Office between President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It really was remarkable, and responses have been polarized, to say the least. Some say Zelensky was disrespectful. He didn't wear a suit. He didn't say thank you. And if anything, this was what Donald Trump was elected to do. This is America First. And then others say this was a dark day for America, for democracy, for the global defense of freedom. America is sidling up to Vladimir Putin and Russia. So before we do anything else today, I just want to go around the panel and ask, where do you all fall on that spectrum? Matt, let's start with you.
I think this was the biggest single one-day accelerant of a trend that should have happened 3 years ago, three decades ago, that namely, Europe should be responsible for European security. I think that the short-term questions are whether Europe is going to defy all recent history and be up for that task, whether Ukraine will be force-fed a deal to sacrifice a lot of non-Crimea territory in exchange for not having security guarantees, and whether American public opinion is ready to support a foreign policy that resembles more Tony Soprano.
Nick, dark day for America or America First? Finally.
I found J.D. Vance in particular appalling in his temperament and whatnot. But, you know, it's Zelensky is the one who screwed this up. He's the one who needed it more. It's a sad day for many, many reasons. And hopefully something good will come out of it. But I'm doubtful.
Catherine, where do you fall?
Thank God we don't have a lady president, because I hear that women would be too emotional under pressure. I mean, seriously, like I do think this is just a display of temper. It's a display of kind of personal biases and personal hobby horses. Like, why was the word Hunter Biden's bathroom said? Like, no one will ever know. And I think it is in that sense a dark day for America. We looked silly and petulant as a nation.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with looking silly, but we're going to talk a lot about that more on the rest of the show. That is just a teaser of what we have in store from you today. We have a very big show. We will be talking a lot more about the fallout from the Zelensky meeting. Also, the House budget framework, the NSA's kinky sex chats, a listener question about judging Trump, a little bit on the Oscars, and so much more. But first, today's panel is Matt Welch, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy Monday to all 23 people who saw Anora, the lowest grossing best picture ever. There is so much more coming right up. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners, Peter Suderman here. Do you know a student looking for a transformative opportunity that supports the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students aged 16 to 24 to the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students sharpen critical thinking in small, dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. Outside the classroom, they will explore Chicago's vibrant culture, touring museums, trying improv comedy, and building lifelong connections. Parents, this program equips students to think, reason, and act independently. Go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Registration is just $800, including room and board for the full week, with scholarships available. Don't miss out. Visit reliancecollege.org to learn more and apply. That's www.reliancecollege.org/reason. By now, you have probably all seen or heard about the Zelensky kerfuffle, which is definitely not an unmade Jason Bourne movie, but I just want to start by playing a clip to give you a sense of the tone and tenor of the exchange.
You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't. Yeah, you're playing cards.
I'm very serious.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
Nick, when we were talking about this before the show, you said this reminded you of a good dust-up on a podcast, and I assume that's because there was an invocation of World War III and a lot of interrupting. Can you just say more about that? Like, what did you make of this exchange and just of the kind of unusual tenor of it?
I think it's important to watch the full thing because, you know, that particular clip that you showed and the little bit before it and after where J.D. Vance really lights into Zelensky, you know, for being ungrateful and for, you know, taking offense, even though Donald Trump has been calling Zelensky a dictator. But when you watch the whole thing, you recognize that this is why you don't do diplomacy in real time. They should have had a deal that was agreed to ahead of time, and this should have been a signing ceremony for that at best. And instead, you try to negotiate things partway through and deals fall apart. That's, you know, in a way that it was like that. It was unscripted. And it's really unfortunate, ultimately, for Zelensky. He's the one who needed the deal. I feel terrible for Ukraine and for Ukrainians. And I can't stand the way in which Republican leaders are increasingly saying that somehow Zelensky is the person who started the war, you know, and that, you know, this is what he deserves. That is wrong. But it's also needs to be said that Zelensky is the guy who needs this more. I don't oppose the idea of the U.S. not being involved in Ukrainian security at all. But, you know, Zelensky really fucked up here. It does not excuse the way that Trump and Vance act. This is not a good look for America. But it's also, you know, ultimately this failure in this way at that time, it's really on Zelensky.
Matt, Nick said that people need to watch the whole exchange. He also said that Zelensky screwed up in certain ways here. And I think a lot of people who are defending Donald Trump have kind of made similar points saying, look, this little exchange takes things out of context. If you play the whole interview, right, 40 minutes or so, it actually looks like Zelensky is the instigator here. And people have also said Zelensky has a history of dust-ups with foreign leaders in prominent meetings, right? He makes people mad. He makes them aggravated. What do you think of that argument? Do you think that that is a good defense of how this went down?
Reminds me a lot of what anti-interventionists were browbeating the Kuwaiti monarchy in 1990 for being an illiberal, which it was, authoritarian regime, which it was. And it was also the victim of being swallowed whole by a neighbor. And so what was the most important thing to stress at any given time? I don't doubt that Zelensky is not always cuddly and not always effective. He's sometimes very effective, but he does have a reputation in Ukraine as well as other places of being a bit of a hothead. That is, and I agree with Nick that he screwed up here. Like his job was not to do this and to also recognize that J.D. Vance, who I think is the instigator here, not Zelensky, that J.D. Vance is set up to do this. J.D. Vance's whole political kind of value add or character was all like, how quickly can I get every conversation of Ukraine to be about the border and fentanyl and illegal aliens? Like, can we do that in two sentences or can we get it into one? If it's one sentence, can we get it into eight words? He's been doing that for 3 or 4 years. And
he's going to be great on TikTok, right? This is the whole thing is just you say what you mean in the first sentence and then go from there.
Well, I mean, actually, in addition to being a joke, it's there's some element of kind of barstool sports diplomacy from Vance. I mean, how many people in the MAGA orbit or just people who are watching this and enjoying it are like given a booyah, sweet, sassy molassy with J.D. Vance's performance here, which is just kind of gross and silly. And I think it's not necessarily resonant with where Americans are. Americans have soured on giving money to Ukraine, but for a very long time, Americans were very much in support of that because Ukraine was playing defense. And that is the most important thing to consider here. Nick is very right to point out that there's been a lot of pointing at Zelensky as if he started this, as if he's the one who's gambling with World War III and pinning the blame on him. Trump has done it several times. He is not to blame for this. Russia is to blame on it. In fact, some of the arguments in the Oval Office was J.D. Vance and Trump trying to tell Zelensky like, oh, you know, don't call Putin a dictator. That's not nice. This kind of gets to where they are trying to do this very rapid change of roles of where America stands values-wise in this conflict. And I think that is indicative of what's going to be happening going forward, is that America is going to be in a position of trying to weigh in basically on Russia's side comparatively in this war, which is quite startling and quick. And again, is what Europe is doing right now, is trying to scramble and to see whether it can contain, it can provide this thing that America or Europe have not been able to do for 30 years, which is provide an actual security guarantee to Ukraine. Biden wouldn't do it. Obama wouldn't do it. Trump wouldn't do it. America's not going to do that. So Europe has to do that if that is going to be done, and if that's going to be part of this peace negotiation.
Catherine, Matt said that Zelensky isn't always cuddly, but sometimes he is, because sometimes he is the voice of Paddington Bear. This is a real fact about Zelensky, is he was the voice of Paddington in Paddington Bear 2. And this is the thing that struck me watching some of the clips, especially from where it got a little bit more heated, is both of these
Wait,
guys
are you talking are about Paddington or the White House office?
Yes.
Obviously, I spent my weekend watching both. And I've got a mashup video for you guys. It's really incredible. It's AI powered. It's just Paddington Bear.
No, thank
and,
you.
Right? And it's Paddington Bear talking to the guest star of Home Alone 2 in the Oval Office. That is what we witnessed. And then you have J.D. Vance, who came up as an online commentator, troll type, arguably the world's like most successful bearded podcast guy. And he pops in with his smart remarks. This is a very familiar type of exchange to people who follow American political discourse. But there's also a kind of entertainment. It's also just a performance and just a show. And what do you make of that? What is this particular dramatic moment tell us about the United States and the way it's doing politics and just the way all of this is happening under Trump?
I don't think it's Paddington and Home Alone, and I don't think it's a podcast. I think it's reality TV, like if we're picking our media. Like, this is literally when people stop being polite and start getting real. Like, this is like garbage reality TV, where it's like sort of real conflict, but it's also manufactured conflict for the cameras, and nobody exactly knows what's going to happen once they start talking. Like, that's what happened here. I do think Matt is right. Like, on some level, it is so wild. It is so like unhinged that we are debating who started this war. Like, what? Like, Russia invaded Ukraine. Like, they, with the military. Like, it's like very, very, very simple. And this is not like out of character for Putin or for Russia. Like, this is what they do. This is what they've always done. And so I do think like there's the oddness of that kind of underlies so much of this discussion. But it is also right to say, like, the U.S. isn't going to do security guarantees. The U.S. doesn't do that. And so, you know, the idea that Zelensky was coming, ready to hand over these mineral rights, ready to kind of do this bad deal to hold on to a bad status quo in hopes of something sorting itself out in the future, like, maybe it's not a bad thing that like holding pattern ended up getting disrupted.
So, fun fact for the Reason superfans is that in the only season of The Real World that was shot in Washington, D.C., was shot less than one block from the old Reason office. Basic, not literally the same building, but a building that was effectively connected to our office. And so we'd just be going out to get coffee sometimes, and we'd be like, hey, there's The Real World shooting on the sidewalk. It's very,
also,
very
I think,
strange. And also,
yeah,
that was the least popular season
yeah,
of The Real World.
I was going to say, D.C. Real World doesn't really intrigue America. What a surprise.
All right, well, so let's talk about
hackies. Yeah, but I mean, let's not, you know, yeah, it's Oscar weekend and all of that, but I mean, this is a reality that goes far beyond whether or not it's entertaining or whatnot. And I think, you know, it pains me unbelievably that, like, Ukraine, you know, the leader of Ukraine has fucked up. He had to, on a profound level, eat some shit publicly in order to get what was going to be the best deal available. And it's important to remember, like, America doesn't owe Ukraine a defense, you know, a security deal or anything like that. And I'm not trying to blame Zelensky per se, but it's like, you know, it's horrifying what happened. And I also think that people, a lot of people in the United States, not just people who already hate J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. I think this moved a lot of people to be like, okay, these guys are not the people that I want representing us. Because again, this decision also comes without any explanation or any larger discussion of what are our foreign policy aims. Because when America does something, it's not just for that particular place, it's also sending messages around the world and things like that. And it's worth remembering, and I say this as a non-interventionist, the United States has shown itself over the past decade to be one of the worst allies you could possibly be. Like, you can do everything that we ask of you or demand of you or tell you to do, and then we pull out anyway and we pull support from you immediately. We're bad at nation building and all of this kind of stuff. And I, you know, from the U.S. point of view, this is not good. The United States, you know, is alienating itself, I think, from many American voters, but more importantly, from people around the world in a way that will hurt us when it comes to things like trade and diplomacy and cultural exchange.
Matt, since Nick mentioned America's leaders, I want to ask you about House Speaker Mike Johnson, right, who is the top Republican in the House. And he said over the weekend that something has to change. Either Zelensky needs to come to his senses and come back to the table in gratitude, or someone else needs to lead the country to do that. It is a pretty clear suggestion that he thinks that Zelensky might need to resign. Is that House Speaker Mike Johnson's business?
No, it's not American politicians' business to decide, to weigh in on, to express favor on who does and does not run a country. It just isn't. We have made it our business over the years, several times, often, including very vociferously over the weekend, not just Mike Johnson, but Lindsey Graham suggested that Zelensky step down. Of course, Zelensky has offered to step down if he was able to get some kind of security guarantee in the future. Mike Walls, negotiating for Trump, has also referred to Zelensky as an ex-girlfriend. I mean, this sort of juvenile take on the world is meshing up with the old timey, we can just do some low-key regime change on the sly. For Donald Trump's anti-interventionist fans or people who invested some hope in him on that front, you're going to be either disappointed or you're going to be inconsistent with how his applications of spheres of influence politics works. There's a lot of people who have to kiss his ring. And it's embarrassing to me that we're doing ring kissing politics in America, that we're walking around the globe saying, where's your tribute isn't enough. Your manners, sir, aren't obsequious enough. Yeah, Zelensky screwed up, but it's absolutely appalling that we put people in that position. Some people are good at it. Emmanuel Macron was in Washington last week. He was masterful at it, of like buttering up Trump while at the same time trying to sort of get him moving in this direction over here, and doing the classic French and European thing of, you know, we are ready to do all of these things, but we just sort of need America to kind of show solidarity for this, which is another way of saying responsibility. So it's a difficult job. We're in this new place. We're going towards a more low trust globe. You can see this with tariff policies. You can see this with security arrangements. And America and Trump administration in particular is saying, look, we are rejecting the idea that America has highfalutin values. We are going to be grubby. We are going to like extract rare earth minerals deals on someone who's being invaded. And that's how things are going to go from now on.
I don't even think we have to say, oh, we have highfalutin values, but if we have consistent principles of this is what America stands for, and this is what kind of dictates whether or not we intervene or not. And it's worth remembering, in Ukraine, the Obama administration, and particularly Hillary Clinton, did everything they could to affect regime change in Ukraine, as well as other places. So one of the things that people who support Donald Trump and non-interventionism will say, you know, what's great is we get out of the regime change business and we don't care about what's going on internally in countries unless it affects very clear American interests. And in fact, what we're witnessing in a way is a return to that kind of older, you know, that mindset of like, yeah, you know what, who's leading particular countries really matters to us. And we're going to work one way or another to get through to it. And that, you know, I've talked in the past about how the problem with American politics is that it's thesis antithesis. And unfortunately, like, we don't seem to be moving to a new place We're just doing, you know, a right-wing version and a left-wing version of the same thing again and again.
Catherine, Matt mentioned Trump's interventionist defenders. Also talked a little bit anti-interventionist defenders.
He's got both, which is maybe a sign that something's going on there. That's a little amiss.
I want to ask you about an interventionist defender, a sort of interventionist defender, and also a little bit about butt kissing, which is definitely a preview of our NSA segment coming later. There was Marco Rubio out this weekend saying that Donald Trump deserved the Nobel Peace Prize, that if he were a Democrat, that he would already have it. And he is the one who is making the case here, saying, look, this is just about ending the war, about ending the incredible amount of death that's happening. And that's all that Trump wants. And like, Rubio is making a case for peace. He is making a case that I think at least has some elements that like some libertarians are going to respond to. What do you think of it?
I never start from a place of maybe Marco Rubio is right and also operating in good faith. So I will just put my priors on the table. But I think the idea of peace at any price is not something that Americans like. It's not something that people in the world like as a general matter. And so this kind of notion that what Trump wants is peace, when what Trump wants is for this thing to stop bothering him. He wants this thing to be over in a way that he can claim victory on. And that's different than wanting peace. If you wanted peace in the world, you might say, hey, we need to establish a understanding globally that you don't invade your neighbors. That would be a good way of maybe starting out to find a more peaceful world. So I do think that this idea of, I guess it's supposed to be kind of peace through strength or peace through, I'm not even sure. I genuinely don't think it's a consistent theory. And so I think that's the other problem here.
So I think I can actually help you think through this a little bit or answer your question.
Thank you so much.
Because I think the argument is, and this, to be clear, this is the argument that I think I'm hearing, not the argument that I am personally making. But I think the argument is that this is peace through accepting reality. And this brings us to the final question I want to ask the panel here. Jake Tapper, the CNN anchor, posted to Twitter or X or whatever over the weekend, something from a source he described as usually friendly to Zelensky and to Ukraine. And I want to read you just a little excerpt from that, from Tapper's source, because I think it actually clarifies some of the questions here. The source said, there needs to be an end to this war, and there are only three ways out. One, America can send military weapons and manpower, and potentially this starts World War III. That sounds bad. Two, Ukraine can surrender and give in to Putin. Or three, we can give the ceasefire plan and deal that Trump is pushing a chance. I would go for option three. And this is, again, somebody who Jake Tapper, no Trump, you know, no MAGA guy, says, look, this is somebody who usually weighs in on the side of Ukraine and Zelensky. Matt, what do you think of that?
I'm fascinated by four-day-old quotes from unnamed Ukraine experts. And ones that like create a let's make a deal. We have three doors. That's it here.
It's the Monty Hall problem, though. If you open one of the doors, then you have to change your pick. So it's complicated.
And note that the
I'd like to buy a vowel.
Note that the U.S. is a protagonist in every one of these stories. Why does it have to be? I mean, I think there's a principled case for anti-interventionism on the U.S. side, or like getting out of the Ukraine funding deal here, which doesn't then weigh in and become a whip hand on negotiating a ceasefire that is disadvantageous to Ukraine. It is simply like, hey, look, we gave you a lot of money. Gave it a good run for 3 years to support you. The tide is turning. We think that you should be pursuing peace. We might even help you in the negotiations for that. But kind of you're on your own now. And maybe Europe will take up the slack. That could be a response. And I would argue that that is a kind of a more coherent response than saying, I will do peace. I'm the only person who could do peace. You don't have any cards, says the master negotiator. Yeah. That's an interesting way of going about the negotiations. We're not seeing that.
Nick, I also love, by the way, Zelensky saying like, oh no, we're not playing cards. This is very serious. Like, I don't know whether he was just on his feet, like taking the metaphor and running with it, or whether it was like an English in translation problem, but it was great either way. He was like, no, not a game, friend, to me.
Catherine, this is a game, and you have to pick one of those three doors: World War III, Ukraine gives in, or maybe we have a peace deal?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, again, like, it is not up to Donald Trump or to this unnamed source or to Jake Tapper about whether Ukraine gives in. Like, it's up to Ukraine whether Ukraine gives in. It's up to Zelensky as of right now whether Ukraine gives in. And I think it's just this, like, bizarre pretense that the U.S. thinks we can have a bunch of meetings and decide that for them.
I mean, Afghanistan could have just said, you know, why would you fight back in 1984 against Russia? You're going to lose, dude. But they didn't. And they nevertheless maintained one of the greatest countries on earth.
The glorious Mujahideen in Rambo 3 wouldn't have happened.
Well, exactly.
You know, one of, I mean, at the very a month or two into the invasion of Ukraine, we released a video talking about, you know, one of the things that Ukraine demonstrated, or the war in Ukraine demonstrated, the Soviet Union, Russia has the second largest army on the planet. It was being decimated, and it has lost so many people that they have, you know, North Koreans fighting there. And this is where the J.D. Vance stuff, where he's like, oh, you're conscripting people into the army while you're being invaded. And he's not mentioning the same thing is happening in Russia. And all, you know, military age men, which at this point means people who are like up to 75, are finding ways to hide or leave the country so they don't get drafted to get sent to Ukraine. One of the takeaways from this, which I think is a good thing, and it's a lesson that the U.S. learned earlier in the century, which is that having a massive army doesn't mean that you can just roll in and take over countries that are much smaller and much more poorly armed. And that's worth keeping in mind. Russia also has a reason to want to end this war, and they need. You need to give, we were talking about this just a year ago or less, you know, we need to give Putin an off-ramp where he can, you know, save face while, you know, pulling out, because his army has been decimated by this and shown to be pretty shitty, actually, when it comes to things. So, you know, the peace deal is always in the cards. And I agree with Matt and Catherine that, you know, this is something where the U.S., we don't need to be playing a role in figuring out what is good and proper and forcing it down people's throats. This could be a model for how the U.S. negotiates conflicts and also avoids them by helping to facilitate a peace process that is not, you know, bringing a leader to the White House, dressing them down, and then telling them to go pound sand while their country gets destroyed.
Just like no peace prizes for anyone in that room ever. Like, even just like the members of the press that were in there. Like, no, if you were in that room, you're disqualified from Peace Prize. Yeah.
Okay. I think we are going to come back to this many more times on this show. But since we are on the subject of fragile deals that might fall apart at any moment, holy cow, House Republicans have a budget, sort of. Technically, what they have is a budget resolution. It's a blueprint of sorts, specifies top line spending numbers for one big, beautiful bill. That's the new BBB. Now, this budget resolution will almost certainly change when it gets to the Senate, but it does show that House Republicans can come together and agree on a budget plan despite the slimmest of majorities. And it turns out that what they can agree on is a plan to increase the federal budget deficit, boosting federal debt by about $3.4 trillion. Catherine, I seem to recall President Trump posting something about a balanced budget not that long ago. And wasn't Doge, I don't know, supposed to deliver trillions of dollars in savings? What happened?
It was never real. It was never real. And
just like Tyler Durden,
I still do. Spoilers. I do think that I still remain hopeful that Doge is going to find some stuff and that there will be cuts somewhere someday. But this budget does not reflect that. It does not reflect a meaningful hope that that will happen. And I think that the thing to keep in mind is, like, we would still have a deficit if the federal payroll were cut to $0, because that's not where the money is being spent. The money is being spent on transfers and interest and benefits and military. And so there's only so much that we can do if we rule out cuts in those categories, which every single person with power in Washington has explicitly done. So that was inevitable in this budget.
Matt, to be fair, the House budget plan does call for what is being described as $2 trillion in spending cuts, or at least in reductions to planned spending. And a big part of the deficit effect, the $3.4 trillion, comes from extending the individual tax cuts in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed during Trump's first term, right? And so those that was a tax cut bill that had a corporate tax cut, but also a lot of individual tax cuts. The corporate tax cut was more or less permanent. The individual tax cuts, however, were set to expire after a decade. You hate taxes, right? Extending these tax cuts would ensure lower taxes for nearly every American. What's wrong with keeping taxes low?
I remember in 2017, the last time that incoming Trump administration was talking about a big, beautiful tax bill, there were still this remnant of fiscal hawks and conservatives in both the House and the Senate, who had, you know, muscle memory of those in retrospect, glory years from 2009 to 2013 or so, when Republicans were keeping a pretty hard line on the Obama administration about increasing spending and actually having year-over-year military spending cuts. And so they said, we will only vote for that 10-year fictitious budget resolution to advance this bill if it doesn't add, in the words of us, then-Senator Bob Corker, if it adds even one single penny to the debt and the deficit, I will vote no.
Well, we're outlawing pennies now, right?
Exactly. So one single nickel, which hopefully we'll outlaw those too. Why not? Anyways, the deficit or the accumulated debt back then was $20 trillion. Republicans, after a lot of hemming and hawing and also a lot of leg breaking and arm twisting from Donald Trump, specifically on the Freedom Caucus, but also on anyone, Jeff Flake or whoever, James Lankford, who were being recalcitrant about that kind of stuff. He basically got all the votes except for Thomas Massey, which is what they did this time too. Now the debt stands at $36 trillion. So you're going to hear about how, oh, they're definitely going to do these spending cuts. You're going to see journalists like the Associated Press I was reading today, describing this deal as like drastic spending cuts. No, there's not going to be drastic spending cuts. When this thing comes out of Senate and conference and all of that, we're not going to reduce the size of government at all. We are not, that $3.5 trillion, $3.4 trillion is absolute fiction. And we are going to continue having multi-trillion dollar deficits stretching out into the future and having debt service continue to outpace even military spending on a country that has the biggest military in the world by a factor of a whole lot. So, I prefer government to be small. And this is not the way to do that.
Nick, only one House Republican voted against this plan, as Matt said. That was Thomas Massey of the great state of Kentucky. On Monday of last week,
it's
he posted on
Commonwealth,
X.
I believe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well,
but
fact check.
Commonwealth, the state, either way, it's the home of Thomas Massey and a lot of really good bourbon distilleries. And so Massey last week posted on X, if the Republican budget passes, the deficit gets worse, not better. It passed. It's going to get worse, not better. Why is he the only Republican to dissent here? What is going on in with the Republican Party, which used to be the party of, hey, maybe we should possibly try to think about taking care of the deficit? And even now they say this stuff, right? Like this is part of their rhetoric under Trump, but it's just not happening at all in the actual budget.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually hard to look back and find the Republicans who actually spearheaded spending reductions. When you go back to somebody like Newt Gingrich in the 90s, when we did have what was called the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War, the way that Gingrich and Clinton ultimately figured out how to cut spending or how to keep spending growing more slowly than revenue was by cutting defense. And at that point, entitlements weren't quite as bad. But the Republican commitment to limited government and particularly limited spending or economically feasible spending was always rhetorical. And it's always been bullshit. I mean, we talk a lot about George W. Bush. He increased the federal budget, or under his watch, under his 8 years, spending went up by about 50% in real terms. And the idea that government could control more parts of the economy, more parts of our everyday life, more parts of the galaxy, all went up under Bush. And it hasn't stopped since. Trump himself added something like $7.8 trillion or a little bit more, depending on how you do it. On his watch, $7.8 trillion in debt was added to the federal government. Most of that was from legislation that he signed before COVID started. You know, Trump in no way is going to be committed to reducing debt or spending or the size, scope, and government as long as he's running it. And I think that's just something we need to, you know, recognize and realize. Like, you know, it isn't, the Republicans don't care about debt. They don't care about spending. They care about being in power. And what happens when you get into power is you start giving people more shit. And to me, the whole idea of these budget resolutions, that when the minute we start talking about it over the next 10 years, which is an artifact of the way that budgeting gets done, it's like we lose sight of stuff. We're in fiscal year 2025 and there is no budget. There is a continuing budget resolution that lasts for a couple of weeks. The best case scenario at this point is, yes, they say we're freezing spending at last year's levels. And keep that going for a while. But
last year's $1.8 trillion deficit levels. Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, and we're going to spend something like $7 trillion this year. Like, how do we get back to 2019 spending before COVID? You know, it seems like things outside of COVID, nothing changed. And somehow we're spending massively more than 50% more than we were spending then. It's insane.
At the same time, those 10-year budget windows do end up mattering a lot, because the reason that the tax cuts, that the taxes are going to go up, is that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was structured to have these tax cuts expire.
That's a budget. It's a way that budgets get scored. And, you know, we should also insist on truth in advertising. Either pass tax cuts or don't. And just by the way, to point out what a, you know, unprincipled financier of government Donald Trump is. One of the good things about the Trump tax cuts, or the Republican tax cuts from 2017, is that they limited state and local tax deductions to $10,000. That's gone from this. When they redo them, they're like, oh, you know what? You can actually write off as much of your state and local taxes as possible. The whole point of that restriction is that it goes to higher income people who deduct more and pay more in taxes, but also it would force tax competition among the states. There's nothing here that is principled. It's only about power and getting more votes and paying off favored constituencies.
My dudes, this comes in waves, but the last 5 minutes of this podcast have really, like, what are we doing as libertarians? Like, this is grim, my guys. Like, nothing is pointing in the right direction. And I don't really know what to say about that, except
it's a privilege.
No,
it's an absolute privilege to be able to be in the face of Leviathan, be completely outnumbered. What are we doing here? That's what we do. We look at this and say, that is fucked up.
We're talking about government. We're not talking about, like, everyday life proceeds apace and is doing well to the extent that government spending does not get under control and fucks up the economy. And you have people in government saying, oh, you know what, we want to start controlling this and that and telling what businesses can do business here or what people can come here or not. Yeah, that's a problem. I don't know. I think this is very libertarian. I'm very optimistic about the world. I'm not so optimistic about government growth.
I mean, you've restored my faith. I'm fine now. But seriously, this is, Catherine, you
don't believe in faith.
That's true. It's just a reminder, though, that, like, even in the middle of a kind of, at least in D.C., but maybe a national meltdown over the existence of DOGE and the idea of cutting anything, in the background is the thing that's really happening, which is we're cutting nothing, we're spending more, and all of the, like, underlying mechanisms to keep that in place are untouched, totally robust, moving on unbothered.
The reason the budget deficit is going to go up under Republicans is partly because of Republicans, but it's partly because of Americans, because this is democracy. This is what the people want. I don't know whether the people actually voted for Donald Trump to dress down Zelensky in the Oval Office. I don't know whether that's America first, but this sure is. It's very clear that the voting public wants high spending, low taxes, an entitlement state that never goes away, a whole bunch of stuff that the government shouldn't be doing. This is what they want, and we are getting this, yes, partly because of partisan dynamics, partly because Republicans are stupid, partly because Democrats are stupid, but mostly we're getting it because this is, in fact, what democracy gives us. It is the theory that the people know what they want, and they deserve to get it good and hard. I will spit out that quote correctly someday. But in the meantime, we're going to hear from a sponsor. Are you being lied to? They tell you to max out your 401k and IRA, and then they make you beg for permission to use your own money. It's time to get the truth. Discover a better way to grow and protect your own money. Bank on Yourself is the proven retirement plan alternative that banks and Wall Street desperately hope you never hear about. Bank on Yourself gives you tax-free retirement income. You'll know your tax rate in retirement, zero under current tax law, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. Built-in inflation protection. Your money is guaranteed to grow by a larger dollar amount every year in both good times and bad. Peace of mind. You'll know the minimum guaranteed value of your retirement savings on the day you plan to tap into them and at every point along the way. You can get a free report that reveals how you can bank on yourself and enjoy tax-free retirement income, guaranteed growth, and control of your money. Just go to bankonyourself.com/roundtable. Get your free report. That's bankonyourself.com/roundtable. bankonyourself.com/roundtable. Okay, let's hear from a listener who goes by Chico, I think. This person signed their email with a hatching baby chick emoji. I do not understand what that means, but I believe it's just pronounced Chico. And Chico's question is, understanding that we're only a month in, I'm still curious as to how you all feel that we will able to be determined that we will be able to determine whether this iteration of the Trump presidency is good or bad. We're getting some obvious wins in the sense that there is at least lip service being paid to reducing wasteful spending. Well, maybe it's only lip service, and shrinking the federal government. But in my mind, the attacks on civil liberties on which the administration seems to be full bore about dampen any excitement that I can have about the work that DOGE is intended to do. Till we get our first libertarian president, I guess we can't have nice things. Is this administration capable of delivering smaller government and individual freedom? Or is it too beholden to the religious right at this point to hope that individual rights for Americans will ever be a priority? This person says that they love the podcast and that Nick Gillespie is their hero and that Catherine Mengu Ward is their obscure celebrity crush. So let's start with obscure celebrity crush Catherine Mengu Ward. Are you really that obscure?
This is my sweet spot. I really would like to be people's obscure celebrity crush. This is a goal for me. So thank you to Chico, I guess, for that lovely compliment. This letter is basically a transcription of my internal monologue. And the only place that I would kind of beg to differ is I don't really think the religious right has much to do with any of this. I suspect from that phrasing that perhaps this person is about my age or maybe older. Because the religious right used to have to do with this. There used to be kind of a much more traceable kind of, visible line between that special interest group and what Republicans at least did when they came into power.
20 years ago, this podcast would have mentioned Ralph Reed an awful lot more often.
That is correct. But now I think that when we do see infringements on personal liberty, when we see limits on free speech, when we see some of these kind of trampling on civil liberties, that it's actually a lot more idiosyncratic. It's a lot more about kind of the culture war in a more open-ended, non-denominational sense, and also sometimes about Donald Trump specifically settling scores. And that in a way that seems a little more troubling than a consistent vision of America as a Christian nation, which I didn't enjoy, but at least could understand. But overall, yeah, we have to wait and see. We have to wait and see how the ledger comes out. And stuff like the way the budget battle is going right now certainly suggests to me that our hopes for the good side of the ledger could be overinflated and I can only hope that our fears for the bad side of the ledger are similarly overhyped.
Personal hero, Nick Gillespie. Smaller government and individual freedom, or not that?
I don't think that we'll have smaller government under Donald Trump, and I think we can pretty much take that to the bank. But in terms of individual freedom, I agree with Catherine completely that the religious right no longer is seriously a factor. And certainly not in relation to what it was 25 or 40 years ago in American life. Individual freedom and liberty and license proceed on their own path. And they are enabled by a general and generally good breakdown in gatekeeper institutions and social authorities, as aided by technological innovation. I think individual liberty is going to keep going pretty well, and it will always be routing around attempts to shut it down, to shut speech down, and things like that. We should always fight those, but I am optimistic that at the end, whenever Trump leaves office, we will be freer on an individual level and government will be bigger.
Matt Welch, plain old, just normal Matt, no descriptors. Matt, what do you think of Chico's question and the hieroglyph?
Very much not your Huckleberry on questions like this.
My dog is Huckleberry.
Of let's get a Siskel and Ebert thumbs up or thumbs down on a whole ass presidency, let alone one that's in its first month. I don't my brain does not work at all like that. On some basic level, I stick by the idea that every president is terrible. Historically too. And that also, as soon as they're safely out of power, I kind of have a fondness for them, especially if they do nice little paintings or whatever, or build houses. And I think that's kind of a normal
not
way.
Not Netflix specials.
That's any like podcasting deal. That means you're still in power and that you should be opposed with the full force of the privateer army. I don't understand the desire even to want to know, is it good? Is it bad? Like, it's a lot is what it is. And on individual freedom, the preeminent one in my brain, which is the freedom of the speech, the Trump administration, despite signing an executive order on literally day one, protecting freedom of speech and opposing censorship, has already been awful and threatens to be much worse. They're literally weaponizing federal agencies to investigate the private speech patterns of companies and individuals. It's awful. It's terrible. It's predictable. And it's also like an own goal, as they say in some sport, because a lot of the people who voted for Trump and against Kamala Harris were rightly sick of the censoriousness of the Biden regime. So there's a lot of things to be said that are fundamentally worrying about the Donald Trump presidency, not least of which is his tariffing and kind of moving, accelerating the globe from a high trust to a low trust type of zero sum thinking. I don't know, man. Thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever. Like, let's just all play defense against the exercise of power and then, let God sort it out in the end.
Speaking of podcasters with power, we love to answer your questions. To submit yours, send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. It's now time for our lightning round. One of the problems with covering the news in the second Trump term is that there is just too dang much of it. So from my perch on Mount Moderation, I'm going to play Zeus and zap each one of you with a question like Edison's kite. It is going to be electric. Catherine, I want to start with you.
Are we, just to screw it up already, wait, are we in Thomas Edison's Menlo Park or are we Mount Olympus?
They're the same thing, Nick, if you look closely enough.
Okay.
We are answering questions from our position as powerful, powerful podcasters who have never been president. Okay, so Catherine, speaking of powerful people who have never been president, I want to ask you about Chris Rufo, the reigning scourge of DEI, who has apparently been tweeting about the NSA. And I really want to stress that this is a quote. I'm saying this because Chris Rufo said these words. Butthole lasers?
Yeah.
Can you? I don't even know what to do with it. What's my answer to that? Butthole lasers. Yeah. Chris Rufo. What's going on?
Okay, so I was forced this weekend to figure out what's going on with this. I'm going to tell you. First of all, the phrase is actually getting my butthole zapped by a laser was ellipses shocking. So we don't know the full quote, but this was about hair removal. And I just want to start there. Like, the way that this is written implies some kind of like bizarre sex fantasy or something. And listen, I don't doubt, what is it, Rule 34? I don't doubt that someone has a butthole laser fetish, but this was just about hair removal. And listen, should people be chatting about having hair removed from their buttholes in a work conversation where your work happens to be the NSA and this is like a, you know, the same tool that people presumably use to talk about important matters of national security? It's not optimal. I don't love it. But it does seem like, you know, this is one of those things where you want to read between the lines. So Rufo published the most salacious bits that he could get out of these conversations. And yes, butthole lasers. And yes, the word gangbang. Just that word in quotes. And yes, some stuff about...
Do you ever get the butthole lasers and the gangbang in the, I don't know, the
quiet,
same
Peter,
sentence?
Just stop talking. And the something about wearing leggings after, you know, your genital surgeries. But the fact is, like, this is, these are like tiny fragments from what was probably a very, very voluminous chat. The discussion in the Reason office about this was actually pretty robust. I know it's a lightning round. I'm sorry. But
Wait. So we were the Reason staff. I am not in the office at the moment. The Reason staff was talking about this on staff time.
Extensively on staff time. So right there, maybe we are just as bad as the NSA. Of course, we are not funded by government dollars. The conclusion we came to was this. One, the NSA probably shouldn't exist. Two, the social norm against talking about personal stuff at work maybe shouldn't exist. But three, if both of those things exist, combining them is bad, and we should be like very moderately against talking about butthole lasers at work if you work for the NSA. Chris Rufo has over-exaggerated this. This is not the federal government paying for trans people to have sex chats at work.
Matt Welch, speaking of people who maybe seem a little bit sick, the measles are back. It's sad. Actually, it's quite tragic. An unvaccinated child died of measles in West Texas. Child was one of 124 confirmed cases in an outbreak of a vaccine-preventable disease. There's already 18 others who have been hospitalized. What do you think about this? Does this tell us anything about the reality of Make America Healthy Again?
I don't know. I think that there's a lot of sort of cheap line drawing from this to RFK Jr. Being whatever the hell he is these days. In fact, we've been living in an increasingly vaccine hesitant society for 30 years. I used to live in a part of Los Angeles called Los Feliz, which is kind of ground zero for kids not receiving vaccine. And in some cases, HIV patients not seeking treatment for their children. And so we've seen this on the increase, and it's increased sharply now and gotten ratified with the confirmation, the kind of shocking confirmation of RFK Jr., who, should be said, wrote immediately a piece or like had under his byline a piece in Fox News talking about the importance of getting the measles vaccine. It's important to get the measles vaccine because it prevents measles, which can kill you. And we're seeing the first deaths in a decade. There have been deaths before. This is understandable in the context of only that increased hesitancy comes when there are when elites and the places that are telling you you must get a vaccine are losing credibility. That's one of the sad byproducts of the COVID over-vaccination regime. By over-vaccination, I don't mean actually taking the vaccine, but like mandating it and firing you if you don't actually take it yourself. That is a horrible way to promote vaccine enthusiasm among the general population. This is part of that backlash. And then RFK Jr. being appointed and confirmed in this position will now certainly, I think, increase the sort of MAHA skepticism of vaccine, and it's going to be sad. There's going to be a lot of people who die from diseases that could have been prevented if kids would have taken the vaccines for them. And that's regardless of whether you think the HPV vaccine is an appropriate thing to put on the schedule for kids.
Just one note to add there is that the outbreak is concentrated amongst Mennonites, my people. Going back, my grandfather was an itinerant Mennonite pastor as well as an English professor. And so this is not necessarily a Trump thing or a RFK Jr. thing, at least not all of it. It is maybe just something about a kind of niche cultural religious community and their beliefs. Speaking of niche communities, Nick.
If I could just jump in, religious exceptions have always been like the way to get out of childhood vaccine mandates in schools and things going way back.
Yeah, and that's not new. Nick, last week, Attorney General Pam Bondi went on Fox News and teased the release of some Epstein information. Something happened after that, like some files or some binders were given out. Nick, do you just want to tell us what happened and maybe what it reveals about the seriousness of Trump's Justice Department?
First thing, Zeus, I want to tell you, your lightning round, you're out of power, baby. Like, you got to be zapping people. This is going on. I'm not going to say what happened. We all know what happened. There is nothing new in the Epstein files.
Well, you're not going to say what happened because it's a conspiracy, right? Because
people who are obsessed with the Epstein files are searching for something else. We already know everything that is going to be released about Jeffrey Epstein virtually has been released, and it's in the public. You can find it online. All, you know, his black book, his flight logs, all of this kind of stuff. What people are searching for out of that is some kind of skeleton key into a big conspiracy that does not exist about pedophiles. I understand the desire to wonder how do wealthy people get away with everything. The one thing that might come out, which won't because it would possibly implicate Donald Trump, it has to do with his former labor secretary in his first term, Alex Acosta, who cut a sweetheart deal that was a minor issue in his confirmation hearings back in 2017. But there is no there in the Epstein files. Epstein was a creep, and he was it was covered up by various things. But we're not going to learn anything new. And people are already starting to move on to different conspiracy theories to kind of feed their need to believe that the world is secretly run by cabals.
All right, if we're not going to learn anything new, then it's time to move on to our final segment. What you watching, what you've been reading, what you've been consuming in the cultural arena. Matt Welch, let's start with you this week.
So Gene Hackman died, everybody's favorite actor, or close to it. He was fantastic. And so and amidst the online chatter, I saw that the horrid film critic Sonny Bunch recommended a movie of Gene Hackman that I had not heard had ever existed. And the way it was described made me think, like, holy crap, really? Sam Raimi directed a spaghetti Western in 1995 called The Quick and the Dead, in which not only do you have Gene Hackman, but the lead star and producer is Sharon Stone. And it features pre-fame Leo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe. Like, what the hell is even going on? And all the guys have sort of floppy mid-90s hair. The whole thing is an artifact of the 90s and should be enjoyed on that level more than it should be enjoyed as a great movie, which it is not. But it's pretty good. It's interesting. Just horrible, like, camera angles and quick cutting. It's very campy. And also, my God, the Riz coming out of teenage Leo and young Russell Crowe is, and Gene Hackman, who's tremendous, is just off the charts. It's a lot of charisma on one small, weirdly edited screen. So check it out if you want to see the mid-90s in all of its glory and kind of reclaim a movie that was just an absolute bomb and panned by all critics at the time for the most part. Disappeared. Everyone decided to hate it. It's actually, you know, pretty interesting and pretty good and super duper 90s. So, Catherine, it's for you.
Sonny Bunch is a good friend, not just a podcasting pal, but also we didn't know it at the time, but we had the same fourth and fifth grade teacher. We were in elementary school together. Very weird coincidence. And then we only discovered this, of course, at a party at the Watergate for Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam. Folks, if you want to know what the Beltway is like, that's it.
And why you shouldn't
now
live
that
there.
That I would like to see in the Epstein files.
Yeah.
All right, Catherine, what have you been watching and consuming?
Rockets, per huge. There was a very exciting space news this weekend. Lots of space news this weekend, actually. So Firefly's Blue Ghost lunar lander made it to the surface of the moon with 10 NASA payloads. It used, of course, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket to get there. And what they are trying to do is answer a bunch of questions about regolith. I know that you, my fellow podcasters, also have a lot of questions about regolith. I am here to answer them. It's moon dust. And the thing about moon dust is it seems like it might be a problem for people on the moon during the Apollo missions. The suits came back. They had moon dust on them. It seemed like the regolith was maybe eroding them. There were maybe some allergic reactions to it on the part of human beings. We got to sort out our regolith problems. So this mission was an attempt to do that. The lunar lander had a little vacuum, so it could just vacuum up some dust and figure out what's going on. Very exciting. There was also a new Blue Origin mission announced. It's an all-lady mission to space. It's going to have Katy Perry on it for some reason.
Wait, so everybody's going to have a surfeit of emotions?
Yeah, it's going to be really emotional. No one's
it's
going to
be just like the Oval Office?
The uteruses are just going to be floating around up there. It's going to be hysterical. And it has Katy Perry on it. It has Gail King. It has Lauren Sanchez and a bunch of other nice ladies. It's all very exciting.
It's like a really bad Robert Heinlein novel.
Finally.
Like, what could go wrong?
Finally,
this weekend, there were seven planets visible from Earth, kind of all lined up. It was an exciting moment for people who want to look at the planets. I'm not very excited about the planets. I'm excited about the rockets. And so anyway, big weekend for space, including a successful lunar lander.
The regolith moon dust situation really sounds like a D&D plot waiting to happen. Nick, what have you been watching?
I watched The Return, which is a dramatization of the last part of Odysseus's Odyssey when he comes back to Ithaca and retakes his claim. It stars Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche, who this is the ultimate boomer version of the Odyssey, because first off, Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche both look incredible in it. Ralph Fiennes, who's very soft and doughy in Conclave, is super ripped and shredded in this. Juliette Binoche has no wrinkles and does not look like she's had a lot of work done in the film. And they basically, Odysseus finally comes back and he is kind of shell-shocked from the Trojan War, but breaks out of it to kick out all the mostly young layabouts, including his son Telemachus, who is completely useless. And Matt, you'll enjoy this. The actor who played him, Charlie Plummer, looks terrifyingly like early 70s Terry Melcher. but the big plot point, and I don't think this is a spoiler, is that they finally kick everybody out. So it's just Odysseus and Penelope alone. Their kid finally literally launches into the ocean and goes away on his own. So it's the ultimate empty nester boomer saga of victory. And I recommend it. It's actually a very interesting, imaginative retelling of, you know, what is arguably, outside of possibly the story of Christ, the most, you know, kind of endlessly told and retold story in Western culture.
So I didn't watch a movie, but I did watch a television show about movies. I watched the Oscars, and it was great, like surprisingly great. And I am usually an Oscars hater. Conan O'Brien was just about perfect, kind of funny and absurd, but also silly and joyful in just the right way. Dune 2 won the Oscar for Biggest Worms, and Adrian Brody was finally recognized for his leading role in Predators, just totally underrated. But the big winner was Anora, won Best Picture, Best Actress, a whole bunch of other awards. Writer, director, editor Sean Baker, who now has more Oscars than Martin Scorsese somehow, thanked the sex worker community explicitly in one of his speeches. He also talked about two things that I really care about a lot personally: the value of movie theaters, seeing things in an actual movie theater, and the importance of editing, which he described as like one third of his writing process and half of his abilities as a director are just that he's a good editor. And I think that's probably true. In a lot of realms where editing is involved. Some listeners might be put off by my description, right? It's, oh, he's thanking sex workers, right? And this is some sort of worthy liberal messaging flick, and it really isn't. It is a lively, funny, screwball romantic comedy in the mode of Pretty Woman. Basically, it is Pretty Woman, except it's set in contemporary Brighton Beach amongst like Russian gangsters and like just sort of working class folks who are hanging out in various bars and diners. There's a kind of a touch of Scorsesean chaos that just makes the whole thing sort of funny and delightful. It's a really great movie about working class New York, about working for the man and the American dream. And that is our show for this week. Before we go, however, do you want to work for Reason? because we are hiring. If you want to work for us, if you want to work with us, go to reason.com/jobs. That's reason.com/jobs. We have fellowships and internships. We're looking for writers, video producers, people who are good at making things happen. So please go to reason.com/jobs. See if there is a position that is right for you. And finally, we want to say thanks. We want to give a big shout out to some generous supporters who help make this podcast and everything we do happen. That is Ivan Prakach, William Flusek, Daniel Greenberg, Pete Klupar, Mike Sherwood, David Kahn, Henry Bramlett, Sean Bergeron, Michael Brown, James Kronk. Thank you all so much for making this podcast possible, making everything we do at Reason possible. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. Like the Oscars, the Reason Roundtable will return, but a little bit sooner.